This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a leading scholar and activist predicts that U.S. imperialism is on a course towards chaos and collapse, and that imperialism's main currency, the dollar, will precipitate that decline. And we'll hear a reading of Asada Shakur's poem, Affirmation, by Black political prisoner Sundiata Okoli.
But first, the city of Philadelphia declared 2018 the year of W.E.B. Du Bois, marking the 150th anniversary of the birth of the great Black political activist, scholar, and social scientist. In 1899, Du Bois published his famous sociological study of the Black people in Philadelphia. It was not only the first such study of Black people in the United States, but many considered it to be the first example of sociology based on hard scientific data. The first of many symposiums on Du Bois' life and work was held last week at the historic Church of the Advocate. The crowd heard a special tribute to Du Bois from Philadelphia's most internationally famous son, political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The late, great W.E.B. Du Bois left this plane of existence over 50 years ago. A grand old man who lived almost a century of life, yet even today, half a century later, his presence is felt. For today's scholars in history and sociology, his texts remain required reading, just as Freud's remain central to modern psychology. Even so, this is, in many ways, a completely different world, with new generations born anew and thinking, seeing anew. And Du Bois, old Du Bois, is new to them. But Du Bois was, as few men are, ahead of his time. He was born in 1868, some 3 years after conclusion of the U.S. Civil War. Precocious, bright as a newly minted penny as a boy, his eager mind drank knowledge from schools in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, yes, but from the world as well. That mind would radiate the better part of a century in the service of the Black oppressed, and later, as his perception broadened, he embraced the oppressed millions in Africa, in Asia, and beyond. His education at Harvard and in Germany's best schools gave him a significant distinction, but his work as a scholar at Atlanta's Fisk University gave him keen insights into the lives of Black young people. His 1903 launch of The Souls of Black Folk gave additional social stature, not merely as an emerged Black intellectual, but in many ways, the voice of Black America. In that tag, perhaps the most read work of Du Bois, his prose has a poetic flavor mixed with what he called the sorrow songs that suffused and informed Black cultural life. The Souls of Black Folk emerged several years after the white destruction of Black Reconstruction. It therefore had a certain plaintive character as an appeal to white reason and logic. Du Bois, at the publication of Souls, is a relatively young 35 years. 17 years later, Dark Water is published, and it has a completely different feel. Here is Du Bois, not merely as an activist, but as an angry radical whose voice is outrage at how Black life is treated in this new century. There is, of course, a material reality that gave rise to this change of heart, or rather, change of intensity. Darkwater is written and published amidst the social backdrop of horror, for it comes on the heels of the teens of the 20th century, a period that Du Bois calls Red Summer, times of white mob attacks on black communities across the nation, where white terrorists kill, shoot, lynch, and burn life with abandon and impunity. Du Bois has learned that the brutality of barbarism does not easily yield to reason or logic, nor sweet pleas of peace. When Souls was published, Du Bois was 35. Darkwater comes in his 52nd year. It is a work giving voice to his righteous indignation and his rage. In his simmering essay, Souls of White Folk, Du Bois condemns this recent emergence of whiteness, writing, "The discovery of personal whiteness among the world's peoples is a very modern thing, a 19th and 20th century matter indeed. The ancient world would have laughed at such a distinction. The Middle Age guarded skin color with mild curiosity. And even into the 18th century, we were hammering our national mannequins into one great universal man with fine frenzy, which ignored color and race even more than birth. Today, we have changed all that, and the world, in a sudden emotional conversion, has discovered that it is what, and by that token, wonderful. This assumption that of all hues of God, whiteness alone is inherently and obviously better than brownness or tan leads to curious acts. Even the sweeter souls of the dominant world had a discourse with me on weather, weal, and woe, are continually playing above their actual words an obligata of tune and tone, saying, my poor, unwhite thing, weep not nor rage. I know too well that the curse of God lies heavy on you. Why? That is not for me to say. But be brave. Do your work in your lowly sphere, praying the good Lord that into heaven above, where all is love, you may one day be born white." W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of White Folk, from Darkwater. Darkwater is a stout defender not merely of black America, nor only of black Africa, but of Asia, India, and the dark multitude of the majority of the world's people. It is a love letter to black women. It is a condemnation of the evils of colonialization. It's also a cri de coeur, French for cry from the heart, from the pains of white terror visited upon the dark billion around the world in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and here in the United States. Shortly after Darkwater was born, Du Bois tried his hand at fiction and penned one of his few novels, a work entitled Dark Princess. Here he crafts a tale of two people, two dark people, a black man and a brown woman, who come to know, respect, and love each other, despite the enmity, scorn, and hatred of the whites. This fiction, it seems, is an allegory for the unity of the dark world that Du Bois felt was necessary to save the world from the bitter travails of European colonialization. Darkwater, Dark Princess. Du Bois, an early key Pan-Africanist, had an intense passion for the dark peoples of the world. He grew into their staunchest defender in the 1920s. We know of his dedication to the black world. His dedication to the dark world, the majority of the world's population, is less known. Indeed, most readers of Du Bois know of his The Souls of Black Folk. Darkwater, less so. Fewer still know of his novel, Dark Princess. Darkwater is more passionate, more honest, more cutting, and more unapologetically radical than The Souls of Black Folk. Darkwater deserves to be read today by the Black Lives Matter generation. He's that grandfather they heard of, but hardly knew. To read him is to know him, to hear his thoughts, to feel his radical spirit. I offer it to you all, for study, reflection, and enlightenment. William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, scholar, sociologist, activist, educator, poet, author. W.E.B. Du Bois, A Life in Struggle. I thank you all for your time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The Church of the Advocate Symposium on W.E.B. Du Bois was organized by Philadelphia's Saturday Free School. One of the panel members was Ismael Jimenez, a public school teacher.
Du Bois operated from a truth, I would argue, a base assumption that Black people in America were never meant to be free. And he operated from that assumption. Nowadays, it's kind of hard to convince people that's even a reality, because a lot of people have forgotten that base assumption, that truth that parents used to just tell their kids, and that that's just the way the world is, and that's how the world has operated. And I think that's very important that we talk about that when we're talking about Du Bois. Now, when we go into Du Bois and Marxism, which is a real interesting aspect, I think Du Bois surpasses Marxism because he looks at the spiritual. It's from a place of love. He's not looking at it from like a cold, calculated, you know, dialectical, materialistic type of angle, but he's looking at it from the Black radical tradition. That base assumption, that special, unique ability of Black America to see through what Du Bois said, the veil. And that is very important to always keep in mind when we're talking about Du Bois and how we make sense of our current paradigm. As a teacher for the last 9 years, I can tell you right now, I got Du Bois all around my classroom, but not one kid walks in my classroom knowing who W.E.B. Du Bois is. And like, who's that guy with the funny little name? Or, he ain't Black, you know, that type of thing. So when I break it down to the kids, I'm like, no, that's W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, first da-da-da-da, you know, the usual line. But then I hit him off with the double consciousness. And I'm like, Du Bois developed some of the deepest theories when we have to come to understand the human condition, right at the very root of it. And he's like measuring your soul against the tape of a world that looks on with amused contempt and pity. Mm-hmm. Du Bois understood that, and not understood it, but he recognized that it affected everybody in the world because of global system of white supremacy. And just speaking about whiteness in that way at that time was way ahead of his time. Because even just understanding what whiteness was still going through its kind of fluctuations at that time of him writing that, where whiteness wasn't fully defined for white people. But that brings us back to the very foundations of our society. Like we were talking about, the very foundations of American society is based on racialized exploitation. You can't fight just for class and leave out race, because then they throw race in the game and mix up the whole conversation. You can't just deal with race and leave out class, because they throw class in the situation. You got people walking around about, you know, Black power is Black capitalism. Not throwing shots, I'm just saying. But when we talk about the very foundation, the first law that this country made in 1790 is known as the Naturalization Act. How many people ever heard of the Naturalization Act? Naturalization Act 1790 said only white European immigrants can become citizens of the United States. They went out their way to explicitly tie it to race. When we look at foreign policy, when imperialism started, American imperialism, right, but also European imperialism, explicitly tied to race and racial theory. See, this is a history that Du Bois read about, was fully versed in several languages. And he understood that nuanced position of our human existence is based on our ability to not be like that, not to become what these societies, unfortunately, we find ourselves in, have been produced to be, based off of the racialized exploitation of the most vulnerable people, the most kind people in the world, and the majority of the world at that. And so Du Bois, recognizing and operating from that base assumption, was never fooled. The only thing Du Bois was sometimes wrong about was trusting colored people of the world too much. So the first thing I think of is him reaching out to Japan during World War II talking about how he supported how can be the races of the world coming together. But as soon as he recognized the imperial project related to that, he stepped back from that position. But see, that's the beauty of Du Bois. You're talking about 95 years, and I always get tired of people, well, the town, the tenth. You're like, Du Bois wasn't about that. You're talking about like a small part of his life. And like every other part of his intellectual being and his intellectual development, he was willing to change and modify and adapt to his learning and to his new ideas. And I, as a teacher and as an educator and as just a human being that cares about other human beings, that speaks to me. That speaks to our very condition. So when we read Du Bois, when we look into his life, that's given us insights to us becoming better human beings. If you ever read about that man's schedule, I heard you could not deviate from his tea time to his bedtime to his reading time to his writing time. He was like that. And his life was dedicated to that pursuit of that truth. And telling people, you know, the truth is, you know, black people in America weren't never meant to be free. But here, let me tell you how I got here. This is what we need to do to better the situation in which we find ourselves in. So as we look at Du Bois from that angle, and I really, really want to look at from that angle, we see another reality, something that is still in the process of being imagined. And that's why Du Bois went out of his way to write fiction. He recognized the power of imagining something that doesn't really truly exist, and also the power of story through allegory. And we keep on coming to this. These things, these truths. When we were watching the video, first thing that came to my mind is like, they sound like some brothers the other day talking about revolutionary nationalism, revolutionary cultural nationalism. You know, the same ideas that were espoused by then, people talking about it like it's new today. And if you read Du Bois back then, you recognize right there, that man was so ahead of his time, we're still catching up to where he left off at. So.
Was Ishmael Jimenez speaking at the W.E.B. Du Bois Symposium at the Church of the Advocate in Philadelphia. Black Agenda Report Executive Editor Glenn Ford was also on that panel. Ford focused on the political and historical importance of Du Bois's book, Black Reconstruction.
Back in 1935, with the publication of Black Reconstruction, W.E.B. Du Bois committed heresy. He placed the black slave not outside of the working class as some kind of peculiar category of human being, one designed to go along with that peculiar institution of slavery, but he placed him at the very center of the U.S. proletariat. And that was shocking in 1935. Moreover, Du Bois contended that these enslaved workers were not merely the passive beneficiaries of the vast changes that were wrought by the Civil War, but that they were the founding stone of a new economic system who brought Civil War to America. He said that these black workers played the central role in winning the Civil War through their slow, stubborn mutiny against the system and by escaping en masse from the slave labor system. And when they did that, they crippled Southern production during the war. In addition to this, of course, they contributed 200,000 men to the Union Army. But then Du Bois scares the hell out of white people in general, and he incurs the wrath of most Marxists of the era by saying that the brief triumph of black political power in some sections of the South amounted to a dictatorship of the proletariat. Du Bois believed that black labor was the central force of the black movement and was also the most revolutionary component of labor in the United States. Or as he put it, they are the kernel and the meaning of the labor movement in the United States. That kind of language did not sound strange at all in the 1960s, as you heard in the film. the notion of black folks being the vanguard of struggle was widespread in the 1960s, although most of the people that were saying such things were not referencing W.E.B. Du Bois, and many of them thought that they were articulating something new that they just thought up. It's only in the last decade or so that what passes for a left in this country has embraced the idea that American slavery was a thoroughly capitalist affair and that the U.S. owes its status as a great economic power to the slave. This seems obvious to us, but they have only in the last decade or so accepted this. Du Bois, back in 1935, his position was anathema, not just to the bourgeois political scientist, but to most self-professed Marxists as well. Du Bois, of course, was not a member of the Communist Party of the United States back in 1935. And I imagine that many of them were outrageously angry at him, at his presumption to hijack the term dictatorship of the proletariat and then claim that term for black reconstruction. He had some gall, I think they thought. But it should be said that the great Communist Party historian, Herbert Apfecker, sided with Du Bois on that subject. It is testimony to the brain paralyzing power of white supremacy that the centrality of the black working class, both the enslaved working class and black folks after the Civil War, that centrality was even a matter of contention. How could it be even a question? Black people didn't just do the work of agriculture in the South. They did almost all of the damn work in the South. Factory owners rented or hired out slave labor to staff their textile mills and their other industries. And lots of factories owned their workers. In fact, there are many sources that say that the white owners preferred black workers, not because they were cheaper, but because they were more acclimated to doing this kind of organized work. That they had become acclimated to doing this kind of industrial work because of the industrial nature of much of Southern slave agriculture. Although the North was far more industrialized than the South at the time of the Civil War, the South was no joke in world terms, in terms of industrialization. It was more industrialized than most of the countries of Europe, except for England and those parts of Europe that became Germany. In fact, the South was confident enough in its industrial power that it had the nerve to secede. But that industrial power, that industrial capacity, as well as its agricultural capacity, was still based upon the slave. Black workers were the heart of Southern industry, whether they were owned by industrial capitalists or whether they were hired out by industrial capitalists. And at any given time, between 5% and 15% of slaves, we are told, were hired out and were clustered in the cities. So there was an urban industrial slavery that existed. That was, of course, part of the experience of being a working class urban person in the South before the Civil War. The vast majority of railroad workers in the South were slaves. They filled all of the train positions except those positions on the railroads that were reserved for white people by law. After emancipation, black workers remained dominant in the railroads until white workers forced them out of their jobs, often by shooting them off of the trains as it passed by. Blacks made up 90% of the workers, that is, the sailors, in the Southern intercoastal maritime sector. On most of the boats that sailed on the rivers and up and down the coast, only the captain was white. And he was the captain because you had to be white by law to be the captain. But most of these white captains were superfluous. It was the black folks who did all the work and guided the boat. As a lesson in that, an historical lesson, y'all all remember the name Robert Smalls. He was the enslaved black man that commandeered a boat, and then he sailed that boat and gave it to the Union fleet that was blockading Charleston Harbor back in 1862. He was part of that black-dominated workforce. He was the pilot of the boat, the navigator, which is the highest position that a black person could hold on that boat. But he was really the captain of an all-black crew. And that was the norm. This sector of Southern industry was black dominated. So when we look at the actual composition of the Southern workforce, we have to recognize that white workers in the South got more than just a psychological wage when they sided with the capitalists and against black workers when they established a Jim Crow. A lot is made of this psychological wage, and it has to be explained, but that is not all they got. They took the preferred jobs that blacks had occupied during slavery and afterwards, and then they made those jobs white man's work. And that betrayal of the working class, because it was a betrayal of the whole class, not just of black workers. When you betray a part of the working class, you betray the whole thing. That betrayal of the working class cannot be fully understood if black people's central place in the Southern working class is not recognized. I'm trying to emphasize how important what W.E.B. Du Bois laid out in 1935 was. The black worker as the main agent of social transformation during Reconstruction can only be denied by ignoring the actual facts of the Southern economy. Just laying out the facts makes the case. The heart of the black codes that the ex-Confederates put into place as soon as the Civil War was over in 1865 and 1866. Those black codes were primarily designed to criminalize blacks that tried to act as free labor. The vagrancy laws, which were the key component of the black codes, those laws were the cornerstone of the old Jim Crow. They called for imprisoning of black people for what was called loitering, and then sentencing them to involuntary servitude, a revolving door back into slavery. This was the Southern genesis of the U.S. penal system, just as the slave catchers were the genesis for the U.S. policing system. So black folks' experience is central to the way the United States has organized itself. Both the penal system and the policing system were mechanisms for black worker control. The creation of white man's work was a material benefit of Jim Crow to white workers, and we cannot let people paper over that fact. After they finished purging the blacks from the railroads, the all-white Railroad Workers Union became the most racist union in the whole country, as white workers joined with capital to beat down the most advanced element of the working class, that is, black workers, and to destroy the governments that those black workers had built. We're talking about destroying Reconstruction. So finally, and I know that I've exhausted my time, what do we call this system that was imposed in order to crush Reconstruction. What is the proper term for Jim Crow? For some years now, I've thought that the best way to describe Jim Crow, I think an accurate scientific way to describe Jim Crow, is as a form of fascism. It's generally recognized. There's all kinds of definitions of fascism. Some of them are just ridiculous babble. But it's generally recognized that fascism is characterized by, number one, the oppression of an internal other as an organizing principle of the ideology. This is the most important dynamic of it. Two, political dominance of the most reactionary elements of the bourgeoisie in a Jim Crow regime, of course. In a fascist regime, certainly. Three, the third characteristic, militarism. And four, extreme nationalism. And finally, fascism is largely seen as the most rabid response of the bourgeoisie and their allies to the forward thrust of the working class, a response to the working class trying to take power. And all of this fits the post-Reconstruction Jim Crow system to a T. In fact, it fits the definition of fascism better than most of the European fascist movements. This fits perfectly. So when we throw around the term fascism these days, we should not treat it as a new phenomenon or as a possible presence in American society. This American fascism has everything to do with the long war against black people and their working class. Thank you.
That was Black Agenda Report. Executive Editor Glenn Ford speaking at a Philadelphia symposium on W.E.B. Du Bois. The symposium was presented by activists at the Saturday Free School, one of whose organizers is Dr. Anthony Montero, the Du Boisian scholar. Dr. Montero says U.S. imperialism is bound to fall, and its currency, the dollar, will precipitate imperial decline.
I think that we cannot understand the political crisis in the United States outside of understanding the crisis of U.S. empire and of U.S. hegemony, and in particular, its manifestation in the rise of alternative currencies and, in fact, alternative reserve currencies to the dollar. And I speak particularly about the petro-yuan as the main challenger to the dollar and the petrodollar on a world scale. Now, I can't predict, and I think no one can ultimately predict, how the global decoupling from the dollar as a reserve currency will occur. However, it is now clear that that process has begun. And I think the most dramatic expression of it is Saudi Arabia, who is China's main supplier of oil on a world scale, will use the petro-yuan in its trading with China. This is something beyond just an ordinary shift in economic and currency relationships. This, I think, will redefine the entire architecture of global trade and the relationships of currencies. But it will also end, and is beginning to end, the special exorbitant privileges that the U.S. dollar has held since 1971, when the U.S. went off the gold standard and the dollar was established by fiat as the principal reserve currency in the world, where upwards of 90% of trade is done in the dollar, where the U.S. Treasury can print money at will, and thus the world, by using the dollar, has made of the dollar the kind of a privileged currency, and the rest of the world has been financing the exorbitant debt in the United States. And the question becomes, what happens if the U.S. no longer has that special privilege in world trading and financial relationships? It could be a further worsening, and probably would be a further worsening, of the conditions of life of the American working people, where already about one half of the American working class lives either in poverty or very close to it.
The essence of the special relationship that's existed between the United States and Saudi Arabia, especially since 1971, has been the maintenance of the petrodollar. Is Saudi Arabia undermining the U.S. imperium?
Well, I think the Saudi Arabians, whether they want to or not, have to act in this way because their national interest is on the line. And at some point, they realized that their national interests and that of the United States were not completely in sync. And so today, the Saudis realize that their economy and their society will be destabilized unless they move to the petro-yuan and a special relationship with China. The U.S., with any number of things in terms of its own energy production, and some predict becoming the major producer of energy in the world, particularly petroleum, could isolate Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. in its own interest would undermine the Saudi economy. And thus, the Saudi Arabian elite have decided that they have to make new global arrangements, and who better to align with than with China? That's the same thing with Germany and Russia. So, you know, it's so interesting that China has literally become what the United States was in the middle to late part of the 20th century. China is becoming the center of the new global economy, with all types of consequences for the organizing of domestic economies, but also it is spurring or triggering a political crisis in all of the major countries of world capitalism, by which I mean the European and American capitalist nations.
The United States insists that it's going to remain in Syria for the foreseeable future, even though its jihadists, the jihadists that the United States and the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks have sponsored, are in a stage of defeat. Could this be related to the clear signs that Saudi Arabia is open to dealing with China in these new ways?
That's very interesting, because as soon as you mention Syria, you're talking about a whole set of political contradictions. First of all, the U.S. presence in Syria has created a set of intense contradictions between Turkey and the United States, between the U.S. backing the Kurds as a sort of anti-ISIS force, and Turkey's seeing the Kurds as enemies to the Turkish state. So that creates a huge crisis on the eastern flank of NATO, or what exists of NATO, because, I mean, everybody knows that the Europeans are talking about a European army that would be separate from NATO. And certainly, the Turkish governments, with all of their contradictions, moving towards Russia and Iran is not to the liking of the Trump administration or the U.S. foreign policy elites. The other thing is, what does all of this have to do with the so-called anti-Iran coalition of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel? Does that still hold, or can it still hold? And what does the fact that the Chinese said that they're going to invest billions of dollars in the rebuilding of Syria? And, of course, how does all of this play out in the framework of the Russia-China strategic alliance? I think, you know, with all of these instances of crisis, of contradiction, of instability, there is one constant, and that constant is the decline and ultimately the retreat of U.S. imperialism as the world hegemon. And I think we will look back in maybe a decade and speak of this moment of the flailing and threat and belligerency of U.S. elites as the final folly of an empire in collapse.
Most Americans don't know that there are about three times as many dollars out there in the world than are circulating in the United States. If these dollars that had been the sole world currency have competition, so to speak, are not able to monopolize the world financial system, that is truly a crisis.
Yes. And, you know, once you mention the numbers of dollars circulating in the world and the amount of dollars in central banks of various countries, you also have to talk about the fact that we have, and that people don't talk about, it seems, so much these days, these derivatives, these financial instruments that have been used to manipulate and control nations and stock markets and exchanges around the world. You know, the global economy is believed to be about $80 trillion, but they're about $800 trillion, if not $1,000 trillion of derivatives floating all over the place. And much of it is about controlling stock markets and controlling national economies as such. So if the dollar is no longer privileged, and we're not there yet, but if the dollar is no longer the privileged reserve currency around the world, what happens to all of those derivatives, which are denominated in dollars? How do we think about global trade in oil in particular, but other commodities? I think this is huge. And then, of course, we haven't spoken about South Africa, which is part of the Southern Africa mineral complex. What happens there? Now, of course, we've had a change of regime, a kind of a soft regime change, as we had in Zimbabwe. But, and I would say that in both instances, there was the involvement of financial players from the West, and in particular the United States and Great Britain, in saying to the South African and Zimbabwean elite that you need to get rid of this old leadership and you need to put in place a leadership that is prepared to play by our rules and prepared to align their economies and their financial institutions more securely with us, meaning that we have to have full access to your banks, your central banks, and the flow of money and currencies in your own country.
You're referring, of course, to the assumption to the presidency of Cyril Ramaphosa, who was clearly the favorite of international capital. But isn't this almost a caricature of capture, to use a term that's in vogue in South Africa, capture of the South African government, a black government, by those international forces? Cyril Ramaphosa is considered the person who gave the green light for the police to massacre more than 30 workers in Marikana back in 2012.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. You see, Cyril Ramaphosa, and for me, these people's political origins, as well as with Jacob Zuma, is very murky. They seem to have been a part of the movement. They seem to have been catapulted into leadership of the movement, and they have a certain amount of political capital as a result of that. And they can sing the national anthem with passion, cry out the great liberation slogans of the ANC. But in real terms, these are men of big capital, white capital in South Africa and white capital, finance capital from abroad. And all they want is to be cut off a certain amount. They want a certain cut for their role in facilitating a foreign capital and local white capital's control of a black nation. And of course, of the mineral resources of South Africa, but broadly of Southern Africa. And so South Africa, as was envisioned at the time of independence, the overthrow of apartheid, South Africa was always envisioned as that launch pad from which foreign capital would dominate all of Africa, but in particular, all of Southern Africa, up to and including the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So how does the rise of China and Russia and the emergence of alternative reserve currencies affect Africa, which is part of that One Belt, One Road initiative by China?
Yeah. I think it affects it profoundly because, as hasn't been the case since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern European Socialist Bloc, now there is an alternative. Now there is another way of being in the world economy. And China and what they used to call a few years ago the Beijing Consensus, the Chinese way of economic relationships based upon peaceful coexistence rather than hegemonism, is available. Now, nothing is perfect. And human beings are at the center of all human activity. And so we hope that the Chinese would control some of its more nationalistic elements in the name of a new global cooperation, especially with Africa. And Africa does not come to the table with nothing. It has a lot to offer in terms of its resources and how all of this will be negotiated. And again, using not the dollar, but the yuan, how all of this will be negotiated so that as Asia rises, Africa rises. And of course, it is a political process. Politics is very much at the center of what will happen economically, the type of leadership that will be in place in Africa. And in fact, the type of internal African unity, the types of internal African economic relationships, because everything in terms of the economic development and growth of Africa cannot be based upon external factors. There has to be internal to each country economic development of a certain type and in terms of Africa as a whole. Now, I think Africa more than any other continent to grow and develop, not only to grow, but to develop socially and economically, has to increasingly move to socialist methods of economic planning and economic development.
And what has been the Chinese record in Africa in your eyes? The Chinese are involved in extractive industries and in large-scale buying up of land, like lots of other capitalists.
And it's been involved in infrastructure development, railroads and ports and other things. I think the record is still mixed. The final judgment has not yet been made. But I think a lot depends on the ways that Africans and African leaders play their hand in all of this. Because China, to achieve what it wishes to, cannot do it alone. And in many ways, we are beyond the era of direct colonialism. And because of the experience in Africa of colonialism and neocolonialism, African people and African leaders look skeptically at anyone who is coming promising good things to them. So the Chinese will be held to a different level of scrutiny because they're not coming as the Europeans came in the 19th century with guns and those types of things. They're coming with yuan, they're coming with ideas, and they have to negotiate with African nations as partners and as equals. And so on that basis, I think we're looking at something very new, very promising, but there are problems and there are contradictions. Among them, the problem of anti-Black racism that has existed for some time, many centuries or several centuries in China.
And going back to South Africa, that's a country in which everybody seems to speak the language of socialism, the governing African National Congress, as well as its opponents on the left. But the country itself moves further and further from socialism.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I wrote an article for the Black Agenda Report several years ago called The Life and Legacies of Nelson Mandela. I think that's the title of it. And one of the things I said in that article is that the compromise that was made with the ANC, and in particular with Nelson Mandela, as he was being released from prison or even as he was still in prison, was a compromise that was based upon the idea that we had to put off for the foreseeable future the project of nationalization of the wealth and socialism in South Africa, which was embedded in the Freedom Charter of the African National Congress. Well, they put it off and they put it off and they put it off, and the masses of people have gotten poorer and poorer, and financial oligarchs in blackface have gotten richer. And the nation is now in a profound economic crisis, 50% unemployment officially, larger percentages among the youth. And it is that economic crisis that destabilized and will destabilize the Ramaphosa government. But I think that whether the current elite in any of the African countries are yet prepared to think through this problem of its relationships with its people, but its relationships with the broader world, unless they're willing to put on the table that rather than the IMF World Bank type of measures of capitalism, capitalist economic growth, they're going to have to think now about socialism. And the test of the Chinese presence in Africa is whether China, which claims also to be a socialist country with Chinese characteristics, is prepared to support and facilitate socialist economic planning and development in Africa. That will be the great test. And that will separate it from the United States and the Western financial institutions.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia. Prison Radio brings the voices of the incarcerated to the outside world, including Mumia Abu-Jamal's essays and commentaries. Prison Radio organized a reading by inmates of the poem Affirmation by exiled Black Panther and former political prisoner Assata Shakur, who now lives in Cuba. One of those that took part in the reading of the poem was Sundiata Okoli, who was with Assata Shakur when they had a fatal encounter with New Jersey police in 1973. Okoli remains in prison and will not be available for parole until the year 2032, when he'll be 94 years old.
I believe in living. I believe in the spectrum of better days and gamma people. I believe in sunshine, in windmills, in waterfalls, tricycles, and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts, and that sprouts grow into trees. I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes. I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth, sculpting mud bodies in its path. I have seen the destruction of daylight and seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind and the blind become the banned in one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference. I have been locked by the lawless, handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy. And if I know anything at all, it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all. It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth. I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship steered by tired seasick sailors can still be guided home to port. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.